So you have been a long-term advocate for dealing with the question of imported oil for A, national security, and B, taking care of the environment. So this has to be a moment that you have long anticipated.
Well, I think it's going to happen again and again and again, perhaps not with revolutions throughout the Middle East, but for one reason or another, we will be in a situation in which we are paying huge amounts of money to other countries, many of which, as several presidents have said, don't like us very much, for our ability to transport anything, because transportation is dominated by petroleum products, about 95%. And OPEC controls close to 80% of the world's proven reserves of conventional petroleum. Right now, they're keeping the price high, even before this last round of revolutions, by pumping only about 40% of the world's oil, but holding on to close to 80% of its reserves.
How large is the risk to our economy if there's an oil price shock out of the events now in the Middle East?
It's gigantic. At $100 a barrel oil, we are borrowing well over $1 billion a day to import oil, approaching $2 billion. Suppose we get a 30-40% increase in oil up to the where it was 2 years ago, 147 or so, say 150. Then we'll be borrowing close to $3 billion a day to import oil. It would be a gigantic tax, and instead of paying it to ourselves, which is controversial enough, we're paying it to Saudis and Venezuelans and Russians.
Wait a second. Your math is, if there's an oil price shock back to the peak level we saw last time, the U.S. is going to be borrowing $3 billion a day from the world, or like that's $1 trillion over the course of a year.
Well, we're borrowing maybe at $100 a barrel, we're borrowing close to $1.5 billion. If you take it up to 150, say it's $2.5 billion a day. And it's one major reason why our debt is so high and why the dollar is starting to be looked at askance as a reserve currency by some countries. It's stunning how, I mean, our oil debt is much bigger than our trade deficit with China. Everybody is worried about the trade deficit with China. Well, that's an important thing to worry about. We need to work on that. But the oil, the amount we borrow to import oil is much bigger.
So what you're saying is that our balance of trade deficit, America's debt to the wider world, is going up for oil. At the same time, we're looking at cutting the federal deficit. There are moves there that would reduce federal spending on energy redevelopment, renewables, so on and so forth. In the present circumstances, how wise do you think that is?
Well, some of the things that we have done are really focused at electricity, not oil, although people like to make speeches saying foreign oil's a problem, oil's a problem, therefore let's have nuclear power plants. Well, since only 1-2% of our electricity comes from burning oil these days, you can build all the nuclear power plants you want, but it has virtually nothing to do with getting off petroleum. The same thing is true of wind farms. Those may be two perfectly fine ways to produce electricity cleanly, but they don't really have anything to do with oil, and neither did cap and trade. Drill, baby, drill also is not the solution. That helps the balance of payments a bit, but with 3% of the world's oil reserves and 25% of the world's oil consumption, we are not going to be able to drill ourselves out of OPEC having effective control of the market.
So what's the solution?
What we have to do is break that monopoly oil has. And anything we can do to not only use less of oil, that's not all that useful because the Saudis and others will just cut back production more in order to keep prices high. But we've got to get off onto other fuels. And it's not that we're addicted to oil, as it's been said, it's that our cars are. One thing is look to Brazil and require that all of our new vehicles be flexible fuel open standard is the phrase. And what that means is that they can use any mixture of gasoline or alcohols, and not just ethanol, but methanol, so-called wood alcohol, which can be made rather inexpensively these days out of natural gas. You can still produce it for $2 and something a gallon with today's technology. But what you can't do is use it in an ordinary car, because the fuel line is the wrong kind of plastic. And it is a very small change, $100 or so in the manufacturing process. And what that would do is open up petroleum products like gasoline to competition.
So you say it's the cars, not us, who are addicted to oil, so we need to send the cars to rehab.
Yeah, well, that's a good way to put it. I mean, if someone comes up with an affordable way, let's say $200 or $300, to turn most existing vehicles into flexible fuel vehicles that could use either methanol or ethanol, that would create very quickly huge amounts of production of ethanol and methanol. We know the technology. We can do that. We can do it relatively quickly.
So that's one point, flexible fuel, to use anything from wood alcohol, ethanol, to regular gasoline. What else?
I think a second is to promote electrification, and this the administration and Congress are doing somewhat by giving tax credits for batteries for electric vehicles. But electrification and alternative fuels, and thirdly, is for fleet vehicles like buses and for the vehicles like interstate trucking is to use natural gas. It takes very little modification to the vehicle, and it's easier, pretty easy on the big ones to do that. And then there are other alternative fuels coming along that we won't need things like different types of plastic in the fuel line to operate, fuels from algae and so forth.
So sketch out for me what you see realistically as the worst-case scenario going forward from here.
I would say one or more of the major Middle Eastern oil producers, worst of all would be Saudi Arabia, falls to a regime that is not only intensely Islamist, as the Saudis are, but also it will withhold even more oil from the market than they do, and push the price up toward $200 a barrel in order to try to cripple the West. Bin Laden has come out time and again with statements that oil is the sort of the Achilles heel, in a sense, of the West, and what we really need to do is keep the price well up over $100 a barrel in order to get their money and to cripple their economies.
How realistic is it that Saudi Arabia could change governance hands?
I think the fact that it's got a civil war going on, essentially, maybe two, in Yemen on one border, and riots and some killing in Bahrain on the other, and is just, I think, extremely worried at the possible course of events in the Middle East. Each day, another issue crops up, another country breaks into doing something. And we may have a period here where it looks like reformers are succeeding. That's often true early in revolutions, whether the French or the Russian or the Iranian one in 78, 79. It sort of looks for a while, maybe some months, as if the good guys are winning. And then the Bolsheviks come along and kill the Mensheviks and so forth, and you end up with the hardliners who are well-organized and ruthless taking control. And so we could have a period of a few months here in which everybody says, how wonderful, we have a civil regime that's not Islamist and is friendly to the West and so forth. But in the meantime, the Muslim Brotherhood is planning to take over and turn it into an Islamist state. That could happen. It's happened in revolutions many times before.
Help me with the history here. If I recall right, Osama bin Laden originally was very angry with his own king and came after us on 9/11 to punish us for supporting the Saudi monarchy.
That is part of it. He talks about the near enemy and the far enemy, and he regards the fact that people like the House of Saud is in power in Saudi Arabia as being in no small measure because of our support. And therefore, one way, from his point of view, to get at them is to come at us.
How did we get here?
We've had a false impression that oil is traded in a free market. Some aspects of the market, once the parameters are set by OPEC, are free. But OPEC runs things as much as John D. Rockefeller ran them in the beginning of the 20th century. The other thing is that we went for many years in which the Texas Railway Commission was effectively OPEC. I grew up in Oklahoma driving on, learning to drive on 25-cent a gallon gasoline. And it was because the Texas Railway Commission was keeping the price fairly low of oil. And we were the world's largest producer up until the 70s. And people kind of got used to thinking that we could still control things. And then when presidents made choices, Jimmy Carter picked the Synfuels Corporation, and President George W. Bush picked the Hydrogen Highway. And neither of those was a good solution. And by putting the federal government's power behind a single solution, a lot of other things got unfunded and ignored. And when the solution came apart, as hydrogen certainly has, we were left with not much of anything. And then people love to give speeches in which they point out that oil, and especially foreign oil, is a big part of the problem. And then they tack their favorite solution for something onto it, even if the solution doesn't have anything to do with the problem. And that's what's happened with cap and trade and, to a great extent, drill, baby, drill, and nuclear power and wind farms. As I said, none of those really have much at all to do with our oil problem.
So what's the role of government to get from where we are to there?
I think government has done this exactly wrong several times by trying to pick a solution. The hydrogen car is a perfect example. That was never going to work without gigantic investments in infrastructure, hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. And we yawed off after that in the Bush administration for several years, and it was never a good idea. When the government picks winners, it doesn't do well. What people ought to look back to, instead of John Kennedy's moonshot, they ought to look back to Teddy Roosevelt and how he went after the trusts. We ought to use the government to break monopolies. And the monopoly that matters is OPEC and oil's monopoly over transportation. And that's why the flexible fuel is so useful, the open standard, ethanol, methanol, any alcohol fuel, because you can use that competition to break the monopoly, and you can do it relatively quickly if you put your mind to it.
Now, you've been making the national security pitch about getting off of oil for a long time. What kind of cultural resistance have you run into?
Normally, what happens is that people say, oh, yeah, I know it's a problem, but we can't spend the money to do it just yet. It's always kind of not refutation, but delay. It's one reason I've gotten particularly interested in Boyd and Gray's point. He published in a very detailed article a couple of years ago that what the oil companies use to enhance octane, once we got the lead out back in the 70s, is so-called aromatics, benzene, toluene, xylene. It's that sweet smell that you smell when you're pumping gasoline. Those are highly carcinogenic. And they're controlled very rigorously from fixed facilities, but not from automobiles. About a quarter of your gas tank is full of carcinogens. And Boyden's calculations indicate that well over $100 billion a year in added health care costs and shortened lives come from us using that to enhance octane. Well, you could use alcohols instead. You could use methanol made from natural gas, and it's not carcinogenic. So I keep trying with the national security issues and climate change issues and pollution issues and now healthcare issues, whatever will work. I look on oil sort of as I guess maybe the G-men back in the 20s and 30s looked at Al Capone. He's done a lot of things wrong, and if you can't get him for murder, get him for tax evasion, whatever works.
You know, in the last election cycle, you worked closely with Senator John McCain, the Republican candidate for president. Haven't heard much from him on this issue.
He's long been concerned about the oil problem. He's gotten particularly interested in electricity generation, is a big supporter of nuclear power for that purpose. But I haven't talked to him in some months, and I don't know, haven't seen anything that he's been focusing on with respect to oil itself. So it's a good question.
How does one get bipartisan room for action on this issue?
Well, I think everybody ought to be worried about national security. All you have to do is pick up the paper and look at what's happening in the Gulf and in the Middle East. Not everybody is worried about climate change. So if you don't want to worry about climate change and don't think you ought to get off oil because of that, fine. There are lots of other perfectly good reasons. I tend to think national security and health are two big ones.
James Woolsey is the former director of the Central Intelligence Agency and now a senior fellow at the Jackson Institute at Yale University. Thank you so much, sir.
Good to be with you.